Mini episode 215 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 215. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here with a great recap coming your way today for the 2012 presidential election. We have two folks in with us. One of our regular cast members, our so-called FDH Lounge dignitaries. I was joking with him off air about this previously. Ben Zobrist of the FDH Lounge. A gentleman who's able to come on and talk any number of different subjects. We have a few of these generalists in the crew, and very happy to be able to have them come on and discuss any kind of different topics with us. That would be our good friend Lloyd Carroll from the Queens Chronicle, Good Times Magazine, and a host of other publications in the New York area. We are also joined today by a gentleman that we're having on the program for the first time. This is somebody that Our senior producer, the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Servillo, has been working to get on with us and was very excited to be able to book for the program here. And after going through the gentleman's background, I can see why. He has an extensive amount of experience covering the world of politics. Presently, news reporter and political commentator for Files RNN News in the greater New York area, reaching several millions of people on a regular basis. Joining Lloyd Carroll and myself, it is Dominic Carter today. So we welcome both of them to the FDH Lounge. Guys, good to have
great
you
to
on
be here,
our discussion today. Tremendous to be able to get both of you on. Dominic, hi, Dominic. How you doing?
Good day. How are you today?
Oh, fine, thanks. So I'm going to be very good to have this discussion with you guys, break down what we've seen this year. I want to start with you, Dominic, because going through your background, you do something a little timely here. I understand that you've been to Israel a couple of different times covering some stories, and of course they've been much in the news the last couple of days, and it's been a little bit surprising to me the amount of questioning about, is this the start of the big one? Is this the start of a big regional war over there? I was just a little jaded because Israel seems to get in these things every couple of years or so, and it doesn't really spread to a major conflagration, but everybody, of course, is on knife's edge about the Iran situation. So based on your experience of having been over there, seen the people, experienced the terrain, what are your impressions of what we've seen in this past week?
Well, I think all of us are collectively holding our breath and hoping that this situation will not escalate into full-scale war. Let me say this from the beginning. Israel has every right to protect herself. And I think that the U.S. is right to stand in total solidarity with the people, the great people of Israel. You mentioned the fact that I've been there several times, and my observation is that, you know, when you're there, we have terrorism threats here in the U.S., but once you're in Israel, I remember riding the bus number 18, which had been hit several times by terrorists. It's a very volatile situation. And you're constantly looking around your shoulder, over your shoulder, worried about the next possible terrorist attack. So, you know, each side is pushing each other, and we're all collectively very worried. And it seems like the situation is escalating, and it's not de-escalating. That's the problem.
Well, that's true. These things have an ability to kind of cycle through and get worse and just build upon further developments with more bad developments. That is a bad spiral that can happen. But I have to just ask you as a follow-up to that, and again, and this is a little bit of a segue to our politics discussion. As my good friend Lloyd knows, I would describe myself personally as a paleo-conservative, somebody who's alienated from the post-George W. Bush Republican Party and the way that they've gone with the whole neocon kind of a thing. In recent years, it's really been this kind of race to identify just with the Likudniks over in Israel, as opposed to kind of taking a broad view of that. And
we tend to forget, I think, a lot of times in our country that there's a broad range of opinions in Israel on how to deal with these things there. So having been over there and having experienced it, what are your thoughts on, again, the spectrum that Israelis feel? Obviously, they're united in the need to fight terrorism and to battle against these kind of existential threats. But as far as where things kind of break down on how hard to confront Iran or some of the other elements in the regional neighborhood, what are your sense of how Israelis go about that?
Well, first of all, you are 1,000% correct. There's a wide range spectrum of opinion in Israel in terms of the political views. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he's in a position, whether we like him or not, whether some of us in America may see his politics as too far right, aligned with Governor Romney and so on. But right now he's in a position where he has to defend the country. And, you know, it just seems like Israel is under attack on so many different fronts. And, you know, the people in the country are trying to defend themselves. There's a situation with Iran. There's this situation now with Hamas. And, you know, it just takes one stone to start this thing. And it just seems like, you know, what I'm thinking about, to be honest with you, what stands out in my mind, and this might be quite simplistic, but what stands out in my mind is visiting Israel three times as I have. And as you know, military service in Israel is mandatory, and the soldiers start out at age 16. And I'm thinking about the young kids that are in the military. I remember seeing when I was there at bus stops, young ladies, 16, 17 years of age, in full military uniform with semi-automatic weapons. And so we're looking at the possibility of full-scale war, of a ground operation in a densely populated area, and it's just very frightening. And I just hope that in this game, and maybe that's a bad word, of brinksmanship, that someone will blink and back down. But I just don't see it. It just seems like it's escalating, and I don't know if the U.S. can pull the situation back. We know that the U.S. has called for restraint. But it's just escalating, and I'm really worried for the people of Israel and for everyone in that region.
Oh, absolutely. I can understand that. And again, you look at the other side of the equation, and we've all seen the images being beamed in from Hamas over the years and how they're recruiting kids a lot of times as terrorists and suicide bombers. So, yeah, that's a very excellent point you raise. We tend to forget the relative youth involved in these conflicts. Pivoting here to Lloyd, as we start to go towards the presidential race and recapping it. Lloyd, I tend to remember on Facebook after the third presidential debate, and I was kind of in accord with you on this, your thoughts that Romney certainly didn't have the same momentum going that he did from the first debate when it came to these issues of foreign policy. These are the things that are a little bit trickier to split the difference on in this day and age. Are they not, Lloyd?
Because no question about
it. He was trying to project a real strength that was hard to do.
No question about it. First of all, I just wanted to say what a thrill it is to be sharing this microphone with you with Dominic Carter, a man whose career I've admired for years. So welcome aboard, Dominic.
I feel the same way.
Anyway, it seemed that first debate, there was just perhaps too much stock put in. You and I were talking about this, that it seemed like the spin was only the first debate counts, the second and third debate, even Obama won, really didn't mean much. And I never quite understood that. I mean, it's like a playoff series where only the first game counts and the rest don't. I just never quite understood that thinking, but it seemed to become conventional wisdom after a while. As far as foreign policy, to be fair to Governor Romney, I think he was extremely cautious not to make grandiose statements, and rightfully so. It was, there's no accountability at that point. And to his credit, he didn't say anything that could embarrass the president, embarrass our foreign policy during those debates. So I think he treaded on the side of caution, including on Benghazi, where a lot of people thought, and he actually made a stupid statement early on, but seemed to understand the importance of not saying anything until all the facts came in. And it's funny, in light of all that's going on in the Middle East right now, it seems like Benghazi kind of is, for at least a little bit, on the back burner.
It really is. And when you look at the prism of a story like that, Dominic, when that came up during the second debate right there in the New York area where you fellows are, Again, that was a thing where it seemed to me that and that seemed to me to be emblematic of so much of what's wrong, really, on both sides as far as the framing of this thing, false choices, whatever you might want to say about how they handled it. And I am firmly in the camp that there's a lot to answer for as far as the initial response to this thing, how things came out, what was said on the Sunday shows by U.N. Ambassador Rice. But this whole thing of the neener, did you say terrorism in the Rose Garden the day after? And terrorism was said, but what was the meaning of it? You're getting perilously close to what the definition of is on this kind of stuff, on what was meant. Did that moment encapsulate to you, Dominic, as it did to me, just on both sides, this whole gotcha politics and what's really wrong with everything going on right now?
I think you hit it 1,000% on the nose, and that's exactly what's wrong with the American political system right now, where no one can get anything done. But let me knock on wood, because it appears that on the fiscal cliff, it strongly appears that a deal is on the way. I think that when we're talking about Benghazi and of course 4 American lives lost, a U.S. ambassador. No one is minimizing this, but I think that we're looking at a situation where, from Senator McCain and some other Republicans, they're looking to score points, political points. Of course, they will say that they are trying to get to the answers of what exactly happened. I'm just a bit shocked, and I'm not trying to minimize this, but I'm just a bit shocked that some on the Hill in Washington are saying that this is worse than Watergate. I mean, that's how far this is escalating, and, you know, neither side is backing down. I think that right now that any nomination for Ambassador Rice, Susan Rice, for Secretary of State or anything else is dead on arrival as of right now, and we saw what the president said, how he got very angry this week. But we'll see what happens in the future. Maybe calmer heads will prevail. Maybe
they will. And it's very interesting on the point of the fiscal cliff referenced by Dominic there, Lloyd.
Yep.
This is something that you and I have talked about off air a number of times here. The notion that, and again, I know you have a lot of libertarian sympathies here, as you spoke about during the past campaign, and certainly I'm a small government guy myself, but this notion that, you know, borrow and spend is the most noxious thing of all, and that's the path we've been on for the last 30 years or so here. I'm already seeing some voices allegedly on the right, such as Mark Levin and some other folks, trying to shout down this potential deal that could come about. But this is just the thing, Lloyd, is it not, where you got to be adult at the end of the day. And if you're not going to confront the American people and say, we got to slash this government and you're going to have to just settle for less from us, which, you know, frankly, I wouldn't mind them doing. But if they're not going to do that, you got to pay for it, Lloyd.
No question. Look, I'm libertarian in some ways, but I also have a CPA and have an MBA as well. So I kind of look at this from a business point of view. And in business, sometimes you have to lower your prices. Sometimes you have to raise your prices. Circumstances dictate what has to be done. I don't think you can be married to ideology in this world. And I think some of the smart Republicans, including Bobby Jindal, are finally getting it. That, you know, this Grover Norquist never raised taxes under any circumstances whatsoever, which I always thought was dangerous, not just because of fiscal issues, but I thought basically was telling our enemies, feel free to attack us because we're not going to have any money to spend. I always thought that was a very stupid, unpatriotic way of doing business anyway, and I think cooler heads are prevailing in this area.
Well, and it kind of gets to what you were talking about a second ago, Dominic, as far as problems with the system and everything like that. As I said, you know, I'm a guy with a lot of small government sympathies myself, but as Grover Norquist has admitted on many occasions, this whole thing initially came to him on the tax pledge as a matter of branding. This is a way to brand ourselves like a superior kind of soap or any other household item that might be purchased at the store. I mean, that's a pretty crummy public way to set public policy, isn't it, Dominic?
I would agree, and I think that if that's the way you want to brand yourself, I'm sure the Democrats will say, continue to go ahead and do exactly that. it didn't work. I'm just fearful of anyone that's not actually elected to office dictating what elected officials are going to do, and elected officials being so fearful of that individual or someone else on the radio that that individual is actually dictating policy. I think that's very, very bad. I agree with the business analogist. Sometimes you have to raise your prices. Sometimes you have to lower them. In politics, it's the art of the compromise. It's always about a deal. And, you know, the one thing that I think this election has clearly showed us, the re-election of the president, is that the people want compromise. And so we're hearing that Bobby Jindal's name, the Louisiana governor, was just brought up. We're hearing from him and others that they're ready to compromise. Let's see how long this lasts. Hopefully it'll last for a while. But let's see the staying power of this, because people are fed up. We already know the issues are jobs. The issues are foreclosure, housing, food stamps. You know, people, some call these election year goodies. Most of us call these things good government. And so obviously the spending has to cut, and I think that all the responsible parties involved are saying that, yes, spending cuts have to be put on the table, yes, but also taxing the rich has to also go on the table. And I think that's the only argument that the president and responsible officials are making. And I think the speaker has wanted to cut this deal a long time ago, but he couldn't. And so now hopefully he'll have the power to be able to get it done.
Well, hopefully something will be able to resolve this. Having said that, Dominic, you mentioned there kind of in passing about the power of talk show hosts in the process, and they are very powerful enforcers from Rush Limbaugh on down. It's very interesting, as I was reviewing some of your columns during the election year and the primary process and how fitful a process it was for Mitt Romney to nail this thing down. And I have to tell you, as somebody who said at the time, I was an early Perry backer, that obviously didn't go so well, but as a guy who said hell no on Mitt Romney, I ain't voting for him no matter what, I don't trust him, he's a phony, a flip-flopper, another George W. Bush as far as policy goes, I feared in a lot of ways. It is striking to me how many people were saying what I said at the time and how few people followed through on it. You have Lloyd, who publicly endorsed Gary Johnson, myself, who got behind Virgil Good Jr. on the Constitution Party line. But isn't it amazing, in light of all that you were chronicling at the time, I would have thought it would have been a much more splintered kind of a thing here. And granted, he didn't match the numbers of John McCain 4 years ago, but the fervor for Mitt Romney on the Republican side during the year was far above and beyond what I predicted it would be.
Well, I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying about who did you say you supported in the primary?
Well, I was for Perry originally,
and Perry. Okay.
Of course that didn't work out so well.
It didn't work out too well for the governor, an attractive candidate. Who knows what will happen in the future? It didn't work out too well this time, but I'm one that believes that, and I understand that people have core beliefs. I understand that conservatives have their issues, and everyone in our country is entitled to have their opinion and their views and to stand by them. But at what point do we just throw everything out if the candidate doesn't agree with your point of view? Now, you could say that on the right, you could say that on the left. I mean, I don't know. I just think that it just wasn't meant to be for Governor Romney. And, you know, he became a rubber band trying to be all things to all people, and it just didn't work. And the right, people like you, just never really accepted him.
Exactly, because the things that he was saying were not at all congruent with his governing history, with past statements made, things that were trotted out of when he was running against Ted Kennedy for the Senate in 94. And Lloyd, I got to say, during the year, you and I were bemoaning these things fairly consistently, and it's kind of funny. You have a tendency to get shouted down by the folks on "quote unquote" your own side
it's
going on. But isn't it striking, Lloyd, how much in the post-election analysis everybody on the Republican side is repeating a lot of the things you and I were saying all along?
Well, they have. The one thing they haven't really said from the Republican side is I'm kind of I'm an old Rockefeller Javits Republican. I like Gary Johnson, who got absolutely no publicity from the media. You know, it's funny, Bill Maher, who's likes to cheer on Democrats and moderate Republicans, basically wouldn't even utter his name. And you think of Maher, who loves legalizing marijuana, it's his favorite topic. Nobody was more for that than Gary Johnson, but he didn't want to divert any votes that could have gone maybe from Obama to Gary, so he has him buried down in the attic. But I'm hoping that we might see a return to the saner Republican policies that I grew up with, where you're going to have government, but let's make it good government. Let's not make it anarchy. And sometimes you have to raise taxes. Sometimes you have to, you hopefully can lower them. I'm also hoping that you have a Republican like a Chris Christie who, unlike Governor Romney, can stand up to the wackos and say, guys, we're never going to win an election this way. A lot of Americans are pro-choice. I happen to believe that, frankly, a majority of Republicans, if the silent majority, are pro-choice. I believe the silent majority of Republicans really don't really care about gay marriage. It's a right. Let people have it. It's not – I think we've evolved with times. Just like segregation, nobody wants to talk about it and say that's a great thing anymore. We all agree it's a horrible – it was a horrible thing. It should never have existed. I see the party going in that direction, and until they – well, I see America going in that direction. I'm hoping that the party will finally say it's time to move that area as well.
Well, that's very interesting. I want to ask both of you guys, certainly on the subject of Chris Christie, as he will be one of the bigger polarizing figures of the next 4 years, as he was for the last 4 years. Start by following up with you on that, Lloyd. It's very interesting. You're looking at a guy who, as of right now, potentially could be facing a very tough battle for re-election against Cory Booker. Cynics will say that's why he was, quote-unquote, cozying up to Obama as much as he was during the last week of the election there. But regardless whatever his thoughts were on this, regardless of why he did it, there is a real sense on the Republican side, and I don't happen to endorse it, of betrayal by the guy and thinking he's just a complete opportunist on this. I'm not a huge Chris Christie fan across the board as far as some of his policy reasoning, but as far as wanting to label the man a phony based on everything that's gone on thus far, what are your thoughts on that and the obstacles he's going to have to face if he's going to be in the hunt in 4 years?
I have a couple of theories, one that was not really discussed here. I mean, I think Chris Christie really, first of all, was the governor of New Jersey and wants to see his state back on its feet as quickly as possible. And the president of the United States, whoever that person, whatever the political affiliation would be, is the best person to help him do that. And I have no problem with that. Now, I know that some of the Republicans thought he was a little overly effusive with the president. And I do have a theory. This is just my own guess. Is that I believe he called both Governor Romney and obviously the president, and I'm sure he asked Governor Romney, could you come by and just take a tour with me? Maybe not the same day as the president, but let's. And I have a feeling Governor Romney said, no, I need to be in the battleground states. This is not going to help me get elected. That's just my own gut feeling. I can't prove that, but I have a feeling that's one of the reasons that Governor Christie did not go to Philadelphia, which is a stone's throw from where he was, to help Romney in the final day. So I think there was some bad blood there. As far as Cory Booker goes, if anybody got thrown under the bus, I have a feeling that President Obama may have thrown Cory under the bus. There's no love lost between those two. And honestly, I don't think that Governor Christie, if he wants to run for re-election, will have a tough time at all.
You know, I just want to pick up on what Lloyd just said, because I couldn't agree more. I think that he's 100% on point. But I take it a step further. Let me start with Governor Christie first. I really believe, and this is just a hunch, just like Lloyd just indicated on his end, I really believe something happened between the relationship between Governor Christie and Mitt Romney, because it seemed like they just, I don't know if it goes back to Christie's bust at the convention in terms of playing himself up more than Governor Romney, but something happened with that relationship. Now, maybe Lloyd is right. Maybe he asked Governor Romney to come by after the disaster in New Jersey. Governor Romney said no. But I really believe something, and I think this is going to come out in the days ahead, something happened between that relationship, because there's no reason. I mean, one could make a case that Christie had to be in the state, and that's why he didn't go to the rally that Governor Romney had in the nearby area. But, if something happened with that relationship. They went from very hot with each other to very cold with each other. And I agree with Lloyd that as far as Cory Booker, President Obama said, I had enough of you I don't know if grandstanding is the right word, but going against me in terms of what he did, the comments that he made, and so it's going to be interesting to see that dynamic play out as far as the next governor's race.
It really, really is. And what's funny is you talk about how that rally was across the state line in the Philadelphia area. Let's go across another state line from Jersey here to New York. This is kind of a long shot when you look at all the different possibilities, how wide open it is. But the possibility of a New York, New Jersey presidential race here somebody who I've kept my eye on for quite a period of time here, and again, who, when I was cautioning everybody that allegedly on my side that wanted Romney to win, I said, you know what, Romney's going to serve one term if he wins, get blown out in a landslide. Andrew Cuomo will come in with 70 seats in the Senate. So my thoughts on Cuomo and how formidable that he might be, what are you thinking on that for 4 years, Dominic?
Well, I have to tell you, I agree with you. Governor Cuomo is a very formidable candidate. He can show the entire country. First of all, it seems like the country is still curious about the name Cuomo. When you go back to the icon, his father, Democratic icon, of course, the story of Mario Cuomo, the plane being on the tarmac, for him to go to New Hampshire and deciding, no, he's going to deal with the budget of New York State. So now here comes his son. And one of the number one arguments that Cuomo can make, and then I got to move back for a second to talk about who I think will be the real candidate, though it's Hillary Clinton.
Sure.
Cuomo, the argument for Cuomo is that, you know, look at what I've done in New York, bipartisan. I can work with the Republicans. I've turned the state around. Cuomo has done very well, and he in all likelihood will be the Democratic nominee unless Hillary Clinton runs. If Hillary Clinton runs, the nomination is hers, and I don't see Cuomo challenging her at all.
Well, before I ask Lloyd on his prediction, so you're pretty much dismissing the Joe Biden possibility?
I don't see Vice President Biden as much of a serious candidate. I mean, I know in his mind he may think that he's headed to the nomination, but I just don't see it. He ran before. He didn't do too well. We all know that he has slips of the tongue quite a bit. I just don't see it. It's either going to be Hillary Clinton or is going to be Governor Andrew Cuomo, one or the other.
In my mind, they're the two big favorites. What do you think, Lloyd?
Well, I want to say this for Joe Biden. I think if there's anybody who, for the Democrats, was an unsung hero, it was Joe Biden. After Obama got routed in Denver, Biden came in and really stopped the bleeding. He ate Paul Ryan's lunch. He made him look like a kid whose bar mitzvah suit was too big for him and shouldn't be on the big stage. That was huge, as a certain other New Yorker likes to say, and yet got very little credit for that in terms of when we look back at the election. I think he deserves some more credit than he got.
Well, before we bring this full circle here, guys, let's move it to the other side. Lloyd, I'll start with you on this, since I know this is one near and dear to your heart. Thoughts on the Republicans for next time? I'll be a complete, for once in my life, idealist and say some combination of my guys, Rand Paul and Bobby Jindal. How do you see it shaping up, Lloyd?
Well, I wanted to see Rand Paul, but I will say this. I just want to complete a thought on Andrew Cuomo. He's the luckiest politician that's been around. He has no Republican Party here in New York. I mean, it's almost as bad as California. I mean, the opposition he had 2 years ago, instead of having a qualified candidate like Rick Lazio, who really would have made him earn that election, he got Carl Palladino, who basically not only was an awful candidate, but cost us the line, when I say us, being the Republican Party, for Attorney General and Controller. I mean, this is how pathetic this organization's gotten here. Edward Cox has to go. So Cuomo's not really had any type of real tough campaign. Let's see how he does when he's actually tested. So I'm not going to anoint him just as of yet. On the Republican side, deep bench, we might see the return of, could it be the third Bush, good old Jeb Bush, who is very likable. I could see that down the road. I could see a guy like Christie, who, unlike Giuliani and unlike Romney, is a moderate who can win Democratic votes, who won't prostitute himself to the right wing of the party. I think he will stand up, unlike Giuliani and unlike Romney, in the primary process. If it costs him, it costs him. But I could see where a guy like Christie could be very formidable in that area.
Well, Palladino's dead to me because he helped cost votes for our guy, Joe DiGuardi, in the Senate race.
Well, that's
there.
My point.
Barry,
there you go.
Help Barry Joe. And on Rand Paul, you know, it's the idealist in me, but he's making the long move through the system. He's trying to work through the system, and I have a sense that he's going to be a more effective reformer than his dad was. That's just my idealism speaking. How do you see it shaping up, Dominic? Dominic, any favorites for the Republicans emerging in your mind?
Well, I think Lloyd was pretty good on this, but I have a question. And I'm not that big on Christie, but can Christie win without the right? I just don't see it.
No.
I just don't see it. I see someone like a Jeb Bush who could give the Democrats a run for their money. It would be a test, obviously, of are Americans ready for another Bush? You do have a deep bench. I don't see Bobby Jindal. I've been hearing Bobby Jindal's name for like the last three elections, and it just never seems to materialize. So I don't know. I mean, it's funny because I was listening carefully to what Lloyd said, and right after he said Christie, he mentioned the name Giuliani. And I see, when I see a Chris Christie, I recall my days from covering a very loud Rudy Giuliani, who we all know the day before September 11th could not be elected dog catcher in New York City. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know what? And it's going to come down to one of my two favorite political columnists, along with Tim Carney, the great Matt Lewis, what he had written about right after the election about how the message for the Republican Party is modernize, not moderate. And I think that's going to be the thing. If you can get on the right side of that equation, if you can convince voters that you have firm principles and you're just trying to apply them in a modern way, that's one thing. If it's a guy like Christie that a lot of people could see as moving against core interests, that might be quite another. But, again, this discussion was every bit as great as I knew it would be. And, gentlemen, when the new year rolls around and we start getting into some of these policy issues, 2013 is going to be a huge year for shaping public policy in this country, and we're going to start seeing the first maneuverings seriously for 2016. I definitely would love to reconvene. Now, Lloyd, it's always a pleasure. And Dominic, it was every bit as great as we knew it would be having you on today. Thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
It was an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys. Looking forward to doing it again. And thank you all for joining us for FDH Lounge Mini Episode 215.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classics, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.